Hi, Patrick. My name is Glenn. I'm a long-term listener of your show, and I really appreciate the way you communicate. I had thought for all listeners on communication to let people know, like, not everyone has or wants a podcast or is into social media or whatever. Like, one thing I've discovered is, like, if you have a truth, you could just paint that truth on a big piece of fabric and just hang it up in your town, like ideally in like an abandoned place. There are more and more abandoned places as there are more and more cracks, growing cracks in our system. And we can like weeds, we can use those cracks. So you could just, even though it's not a socially approved or well understood or used way of communication, you could just say what you want and put it up. And someone's going to see it and they'll be like, what is this? It doesn't need to be even need to be artistic. It doesn't need to be good. It doesn't need to be, it's just someone's going to see it and they're going to be like, who's communicating to me outside of normal channels? Like, what's going on? And there maybe will be a connection. I'd encourage people to do it. I do it, throughout New York City. And it just feels really good, and it lots of people see it, and it's just there, and it becomes part of the background instead of, you know, this co-opted background. And I think it's a way of communicating that can't really be co-opted. So I just want to tell people to paint your truth really big and then hang it somewhere really high, and then other people will see it like a smoke signal or a message in the bottle. So like 5 years ago, I was a top partner at a big Wall Street law firm, and now I climb things and hang messages, things I want to say, and most usually other people I want to support and elevate. And yeah, I think more people should do it. But I appreciate how you speak your truth, and it's meant a lot to me. I think we could all make each other feel less alone because we're not alone. Thanks. Have a good day.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. And thank you, Glenn, for that message. Really appreciate your thoughts there. Thanks for making that connection. And actually, after making that connection with Glenn posts most of their stuff, as far as I can tell anyway, on their Instagram profile. I'll just turn people onto that. That's Climbit Justice. That's CLIMBIT Justice, JUSTICE, on Instagram. There you'll find a Linktree link, and you'll find their Twitter, you'll find all of the other information that you need to know about their work putting up really excellent pieces around New York City. So I really want to thank them for, again, their insights. I think that is really important, that sometimes we need to think a little bit outside the box as far as how to, you know, get this message out there, whatever that message is to you. But to get it out there, disrupt maybe people's day-to-day life and, you know, remember like, oh yeah, we are living in a time of extreme precarity and climate emergency. And if you want to do what Glenn did, which is leave a message I can feature on the podcast, or if you just want to share some thoughts with me and not have it featured on the podcast, just please let me know in the message. You can do that by calling the phone number 208-918-2837. That's a really easy way to do it. The time limit is 3 minutes. If you want to leave a longer message, there is a link, which you can find in the description of this episode and on the website, to leave an audio file and drop it. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. On with the episode.
At the very origins of industrialization, the first industrial working class in the United States was made up of women, almost exclusively. The biggest corporations at the time were textile manufacturing companies. They hired almost exclusively women to run their factories. And they did it because women were cheaper, their labor was valued less, but also because they were less able to resist. Women in the 19th century were not able to vote or run for office. They were ridiculed if they spoke in public, like if they gave an address to a group of men or a mixed audience. they would be demonized for sort of violating their social role as being confined to the domestic sphere. And so these working class women said, hey, you know what? We're getting exploited on the job. We're working 12 to 14 hours a day. We face dangerous conditions in which people are getting injured and sometimes killed in industrial accidents. And we can't complain about it. We can't even talk about it. We can't address these issues because we're simultaneously facing oppression as women in this society. And so they said, you know what? We have to critique both. We have to struggle against both. One author wrote that they recognize that capitalism and patriarchy were oppressing them. And she said, we have to war with oppression in every form.
In this episode, I speak with Michael Regan. Michael is a historian, teacher, and activist, and he joins me to discuss his book, Intersectional Class Struggle, Theory and Practice, which is an innovative study exploring the relevance of class as a theoretical category in our world today, arguing that leading traditions of class analysis have missed major elements of what class is and how it operates. In our time of increasing wealth disparity and widespread socioeconomic precarity for the working class, which has been dubbed the Second Gilded Age, how can intersectionality as a theoretical framework and practice help us more deeply understand and appreciate the liberatory struggles of racial, economic, and feminist movements? Regan, through his excellent historical documentation in Intersectional Class Struggle, has provided a more nuanced and richer view of class consciousness that does not fit into crude boxes. And to quote the description of this book, using a historical lens, it studies the experiences of working class peoples from migrant farm workers in California's Central Valley to the factory girls of New England and black workers in the South to explore the variety of working class experiences. It investigates how the concepts of racial capitalism and black feminist thought, when applied to class studies and popular movements, allow us to walk and chew gum at the same time, to recognize that our movements can be diverse and particularistic, as well as have elements of the universal experience shared by all workers. Ultimately, it argues that class is made up of all of us. It is of ourselves in our contradiction and complexity. So this interview was recorded a few weeks ago, and I was really excited to have this conversation with Michael. I think this conversation around intersectionality is so tied to some controversial subjects around critical race theory, which has been so maligned and misrepresented particularly in conservative media, but not just in conservative media, but also within some leftist circles as well, as I've seen, unfortunately. Although I would say that there can be a nuanced discussion that does give proper context to what intersectionality is and how that fits within critical race theory, or how those two work to understand oppression and the various intersecting identities and struggles that exist presently and in our past. But I think a lot of times these things can be purposefully decontextualized in order to assert some kind of altogether false perspective about what these struggles have been about and what intersectionality actually presents to us. And I think what Michael does here is he uses very clear language to explain how class struggle, class consciousness has always been intersectional, and that our understanding of class cannot be something that is just material conditions or just something that is tied to your economic position. I think that even those that have dissected class consciousness or have attempted to analyze and provide theory around this framework have always, many of them at least, have understood that there's always an intersection of different struggles here, of different identities. I think there's actually one other thing I would like to quote here before we move on to this interview. And Michael had written about this subject in an article for Roar magazine. The title of that article is Intersectional Class Struggle from Shared Oppression to Unified Resistance. Quote, mainstream ideas about class correlate it to income or education, while some left thinkers tie it strictly to a relationship to the means of production. In some contemporary activist circles, class is thought of as identity and classism as a form of discrimination akin to racism or sexism. These ideas about class are not wrong, but they are incomplete. They highlight only a part of the complex social phenomenon that is class. The US and the UK are perhaps the worst in this regard. Mainstream discourse on class equates many working class people with the middle class, a poorly defined group categorized as neither rich nor poor. Middling notions of class hide the class struggle in daily life that are plain for all to see if we choose to look. On the left, magazines like Jacobin and other left journals are different, but also offer a limited perspective. They tend to argue that class is, at base, a material condition different from other forms of social struggle and more fundamental than the others. By tying class strictly to material conditions, a relationship to a means of production, these ideas unnecessarily delimit working class struggle. As British historian E.P. Thompson demonstrated 60 years ago, class struggle is not solely material, but a product of class consciousness, which can come from many different vectors of identity, experience, and conflict. End quote. I think that sums it up pretty well, and I really want to thank Michael for taking the time to have this interview with me to discuss some of the nuances of this subject. I really appreciate their work a great deal, and if you want to pick up a copy of Intersectional Class Struggle Theory and Practice, you can do that by going to akpress.org. I'll be providing a link to that down in the description. I will also provide a link to the bookshop.org affiliate link. You can purchase that directly through Bookshop. I really like Bookshop. I think it's a really great alternative to big retail stores like Amazon or others. It really helps support independent booksellers. If you'd like to learn more about my work specifically, you can go to my website, lastbornin.thewilderness.com. Everything will be there. If you want to support my work, the first thing to do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That's one place that you can leave a review. That'll actually help bring more visibility to the podcast. So if you listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving a review. If you'd like to directly support this work monetarily, you can do that through two means. The first is through a one-time donation. You can do that through PayPal or Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Leave a donation there or on Venmo at Lastborn Podcast. The second way is through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/lastbornin.thewilderness. Contribute there for as little as $1 a month. You'll gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly, and you will also gain access to some other exclusive content as well. And depending on what tier you support me at, you'll also get some swag like stickers and a t-shirt and stuff like that. That is it, everybody. Thank you so much for your attention. And without any further delay, here is my interview with Michael Regan. Michael, thanks for coming on the podcast. It's really great to connect with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
Yeah, Shane, we were talking about this before we started recording. Shane Burley connected us. It's been really good. Well, one, I've just had a lot of really great interviews with him, good conversations with him over the past several years, but he's also turned me on to some really great writers and activists and others over the past however many years as well. So I have to thank him, of course, for setting that, well, in many ways, helping set this thing up. So thanks to Shane.
Yeah, he's a great writer and great journalist.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, well, the book that you just published through AK Press is Intersectional Class Struggle, Theory and Practice. And, you know, this question around intersectionality has been, I guess we can get into this a little later, get into some of the questions around how it's become, whether we're talking about in the broader sense, it's a controversial theory or subject or framework in which to understand things for some reason. Mm-hmm. But it's also like kind of contentious even within the left. So maybe I'll just ask first off, before we get into some of that, I'll just ask you why write this book right now and why get it published right now in your view?
Great question. Well, I was partially trying to speak to the contemporary political moment. I mean, we are experiencing what many people are calling the second Gilded Age, you know, the greatest forms of wealth inequality seen in at least 100 years, if not more. These astronomical fortunes for the first time billionaires and now 100 billionaires and multiple hundreds of billionaires, while we see widespread poverty and homelessness in our cities, decline in the standard of living and even life expectancy for segments of the population in the United States and elsewhere. Really, you know, hard conditions for regular people and astronomical wealth for the rest of society. And so it seems fundamentally that there's a question of class happening around us. We can experience it and see it with our own eyes. But our vocabulary and kind of traditions for talking about class or thinking about it in complex ways seemed somewhat diminished. There were kind of two major schools of thought around this, one coming from the left and kind of socialist traditions, those most heavily influenced by like kind of Marxist ideas that put a heavy emphasis on what they call our material factors, like economic factors. Marx's famous phrase here is the relationship to the means of production kind of defines someone's class position. And those are all good ideas, but seem somewhat limited. And then the other way activists and scholars are talking about classes in relationship to intersectionality. And these are also good ideas. They point to the way that class is what they call intersectional, meaning it has relationships and is co-formed by race and gender and sexuality and these other things. But in that tradition, the understanding of class seemed somewhat underdeveloped, like not very robust. It was missing some of the elements of the tradition of class struggle from working peoples themselves that I thought it was important to highlight. And it just seemed like a moment where people were kind of touching at the edges of this conversation, but not really getting at the heart of intersectional class struggle itself and what it means to be working class in the 21st century and what we need to organize to fight against these forms of inequality and oppression in our lives. So I was hoping to, you know, contribute something to help with that conversation.
Yeah, and reading the book, what I have read of it is that you state everything in really clear terms. And it's interesting because I was thinking about why this book is so good is one, it's the clear language that you use to describe these things, but also just some of the things, and this isn't by any means saying anything about your book in particular, but just the concept itself seems so obvious that we should have an intersectional approach to understanding the systems that we exist within. It just seems really obvious. And then for some reason, it seems like you're describing these different schools of thought, these different ways in which different people have tried to tackle these subjects. And it seems like we have this thing where we want to break everything down into these categories. And then for whatever reason, those things don't mix together very well in the ways that people attempt to address these things theoretically or through activism. And there's even seems to be resistance to doing that to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And I'm curious in your work and what you've done so far, maybe I'll ask you what sort of resistance you've seen to that in what you've done, and also maybe some of the reasons as to why you think that would be the case, why there would be a resistance to approaching class from an intersectional framework.
What a great question. I can't really answer the second part. Why? It seems so self-evident to me that these things are intersectional and we should treat them in an intersectional way. You know, many people before me have said that class is an experience that's mediated through race and gender. And when we look at, you know, even it's just strictly economic questions, like, for example, unemployment rates. Black people in the United States face unemployment rates twice that of whites almost consistently throughout the 20th and 21st century, where they have income inequality that is about 10 times greater than what whites experience. Or, I mean, on and on and on. It's just so evident that race and gender are fundamental components of what makes the class experience meaningful and happen for so many different types of people. So I don't quite understand the resistance to talking about it in this way. And I do see it coming from both sides. I think, you know, in contemporary activist and organizing and sometimes scholarly and academic circles, there are people who are very stridently putting forward a kind of class first analysis that seek to define class as strictly material, and therefore other forms of oppression are like less important, like race or gender. Important, you know, they think they're worthy of talking about and struggling against, but they kind of set class apart as being a case distinct and more significant. and from intersectional theorists who see people talking about class as being what they call class reductionist, and they don't take into account the importance of race. And so there's kind of an impasse. They're like these camps. And I don't understand why people are so insistent on this division, because it seems like a fairly easy, you know, theoretical fix, at least, if harder to put into practice. But
yeah. Well, what I've heard from the side, and I don't agree with them, but I've been familiar with these individuals that are saying that when we talk about intersectionality, that it excludes the question of class, you know, the economic classes that we're a part of, that it doesn't really want to address the roots of capitalism and its form and the way that it oppresses us or, you know, produces alienation and all of these other effects. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons they say, and it's interesting, and I kind of half agree with it to a point, which is that by not focusing on class, on the materialist or economic side of it, because that side of it's so difficult to address because capitalism governs everything in our lives, that it's easier to control other aspects of the intersectional forms of oppression. Like, it's easier to address race or gender or mm-hmm. sexuality or any of these other things than it is to address capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like sometimes a lot of this is really just, it's almost reactionary, right? It's like, this thing isn't being emphasized enough, so we're going to overemphasize it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to then, it seems like that's kind of what's going on. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, and I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, because it's true that in this country and elsewhere, you know, there's been a 100-year tradition coming from business communities and academic think tanks and elsewhere, trying to drive class out of the conversation, trying to frame a narrative about American society as one as like uplift and meritocracy. And and there's ideological work around that with, you know, for example, Koch brother founded research centers and, you know, all of this kind of work, but also an assault on, you know, leftist organizations and a strong component of anti-communism in the United States that has tried to disrupt mm-hmm. Working class organizations in the U.S. So I can understand trying to bend the stick back a little bit and say, like, okay, you know what, we do really need to focus on class, but I think it hurts the cause if the focus is so narrowly defined as to not really encompass what the class experience is and what it means to be working class and the tremendous variety and diversity that are found within working class peoples and working class struggles. And, you know, it might be easy to just emphasize the material aspects, and it's certainly important. And I don't think the material understanding of class is wrong. I agree with many of the people in the Marxist tradition, but it's just not quite enough. And as we try to build movements today, around a working class politics, we need some theoretical ideas that can help reflect the true diversity and interest of working class people today. And so hopefully this is embraced as like some constructive criticism, you know, a corrective right. and not an attack on people trying to do that.
Yeah. Something, if you could comment on this and elaborate on this further, but you're attempting to define, or you are defining class in this book as being, it seems to be a combination of that materialism that we see within the Marxist tradition, but it's combining it with cultural aspects as well. Could you get into that?
Sure. Well, there's a very strong tradition of cultural studies that comes out of Marxist materialism in the 20th century to try to think about, you know, really answer a basic question that came out of Marxist economics, which is, if class is solely determined by a relationship to the means of production, as Marx says, and that relationship is not serving the interest of working class people and will lead to an inevitable kind of disruption or revolt from the working class who have the interest to thwart capitalist exploitation. Why haven't we seen that yet? You know, why hasn't there been this sort of progression towards greater and greater working class consciousness and greater working class organizations? And people really at the beginning of the 20th century, like Italian Marxist and communist Gramsci, and then later in the century with British historians like E.P. Thompson, and then even later with Jamaican-born cultural studies theorist Stuart Hall, they all started to consider, well, okay, yes, material factors are important. They are a key part of defining class and class struggle. The central critique of Marx was right in that working class people are continually being exploited and have antithetical interests to the rich or the property class. But also we need to take into account how people think about themselves, how they understand the world around them, their consciousness and experiences of day-to-day life and class struggle, and that these are profoundly cultural questions. That the worldview that people use to explain the world to themselves can contribute to class consciousness and class struggle, or detract from it, or emphasize certain parts over others. And in fact, as I was putting together the book, I think you begin to actually see this in working class people's struggles themselves. That is, as, you know, factory workers or homemakers or unemployed struggles or other things like this, as people take on political activism and start to build social movements around their issues, they necessarily have to struggle against the intersectional nature of the reality they face. So just to take one short example that comes up in the book, at the very origins of industrialization, the first industrial working class in the United States was made up of women almost exclusively. The biggest corporations at the time were textile manufacturing companies. They hired almost exclusively women to run their factories. And they did it because women were cheaper, their labor was valued less, but also because they were less able to resist. Women in the 19th century were not able to vote or run for office. They couldn't, you know, they were ridiculed if they spoke in public, like if they gave an address to a group of men or a mixed audience, they would be demonized for sort of violating their social role as being confined to the domestic sphere. And so these working class women said, hey, you know what? We're getting exploited on the job. We're working 12 to 14 hours a day. We face dangerous conditions in which people are getting injured and sometimes killed in industrial accidents. And we can't complain about it. We can't even talk about it. We can't address these issues because we're simultaneously facing oppression as women in this society. And so they said, you know what, we have to critique both. We have to struggle against both. One author wrote that, you know, they recognized that capitalism and patriarchy were oppressing them. And she said, we have to war with oppression in every form. You know, it took a while, I think, for the theorists to catch up to that experience coming from working class peoples. And it's evident in that experience that it's, you know, one part culture, one part material and economic exploitation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I think the examples that you give, talking about the women that were struggling at that time, and there's also, it's also how white supremacy operates, because it is a cultural thing to have. I mean, we think of, you know, race as being a societal construct. It's very real, but it's something that was constructed over centuries. And it's always been so fascinating to, it's disturbing and it's bad, but it's something that's fascinating to observe how working class people could be made to work against each other based on these cultural attitudes that they have. So
right.
Men and women have the same interests ultimately when it comes to working class issues. You know, people of various races would have the same interests as well. And yet somehow over the centuries, there has been antagonisms built between these groups that don't need to be there. They've never needed to be there. And that is a tool that is used by, well, you could say that those that run the society, the wealthy, to create those antagonisms too. And it seems like whenever there is like a real push to bring those common interests to the forefront, there seems to be examples of the ruling class using these cultural antagonisms as a way to create divisions. Are there historical and even contemporary examples of this that you can draw on?
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. I the most famous, I think, and the one that comes up in the book is what's called the Morgan thesis, named for a historian of early American history, Edmund Morgan, who wrote about the advent of slavery in the Virginia colony and wrote about it in class terms, in particular, thinking about slavery, obviously, as a form of labor exploitation, right? Why are people being enslaved? Because it's profitable for an ownership class to kind of exploit that labor. But the question he was asking is a little bit different. It was, why was slavery racialized? It didn't have to be racialized in this way. The English poor could just have easily been enslaved. And in some cases, their conditions as indentured servants were pretty similar. So he's saying, why was slavery racialized in this way? And the answer that he looks to is that, in fact, racial divisions and racializing the labor force was useful to the colonial ruling elite, the ownership class of 17th century Virginia, because it separated the working force from having sympathies with each other. That is, if you can divide the colonial working class, indentured servants, around whiteness and slavery around blackness, in particular, whites could be imbued with this notion of superiority and difference that kept them distinct from the enslaved populations, and would then work to enforce that difference and that social hierarchy that gave them forms of social privilege. And it would make it much harder for black and white workers in colonial Virginia to unite. Morgan uses this language. He says it was almost intentional that this was done. I don't know if it was intentional, but if we think about the structural outcome of how, you know, white supremacy operates today, absolutely. And it's not just around white and black issues, but we can see it with, you know, demonization and alienization of immigrant populations, all kinds of vitriolic language used to against ethnic minorities in other countries as well, that kind of foster these forms of division within the working class.
You know, it's interesting. We can use the same framework of intersectionality to describe the ways in which people are oppressed. But there's also an intersectionality of the ways in which the ruling class uses, I don't know how to say this, maybe it's all under the same umbrella, mm-hmm. but it's like, there's all of these things, you look at it like a toolkit, like, okay, what's going to be used to create division among people that have more in common than not, right? Mm-hmm. So think of the ruling class, like, how many forms of division can we throw at people to create a sense of anxiety, paranoia, or whatever it is for them to fear the other when they actually have more in common. So
right.
I think about like, okay, well, you're white, so you identify with your white oppressors more than you do with your, you know, fellow, black working class comrades, right?
Right.
Or you're going to fear women seeking equality in every aspect of life because, I don't know, it's going to take something from you as a man to have that happen. Or you're going to, if you let immigrants have even a modicum of the rights that you hold as a U.S. citizen, that's going to somehow take something from you as well. It's like there's always there's like a playbook that they seem to follow, and it's sort of sad. I mean, it can be fought against. I don't want to like this isn't meant to be pessimistic or anything like that, but it's how easily susceptible people are to those antagonisms, you know, and how can like working class consciousness and this sort of intersectional class consciousness that you're bringing up in your book be a way to counter those mm-hmm. things? Yeah.
It's true. I mean, you're right. And it happens over and over again. And the populations who are being demonized may change decade by decade, but we see the same kind of phenomenon happen around, you know, different sets of immigrant populations or different sets of racial or gender divisions. And I think for us as like, you know, activists and organizers and movement people, we have to like question why that's happening and interrogate it a little bit and be curious about it to try to understand better what the problem is such that we can try to really, really tackle it. And part of the argument that I'm making in the book is that there's a structural component in society since the advent of industrial capitalism around labor markets, that the fact that we sell our labor on the market in a competitive system where supply and demand sets the price of how much our work and our lives are valued means that we all have competitive interests to restrict that market and keep out competition based in whatever metric we can find, whether that's keeping women out of certain employments or immigrants out or racial minorities or whomever else, that there's a profound structural component that kind of fosters this notion of, you know, if we demonize and antagonize others, we can protect our kind of market position and our market privilege. And if we're serious about trying to tackle, you know, anti-racism in the society, it means we necessarily have to look at the structures of capital, including labor markets, and figure out ways to undo them. If we're serious about really being anti-racist.
Yeah. It's a monumental task, but it seems like it's happening. I don't know. Maybe I'll ask you this, because I think that I have this problem where I look at the enormity of the problem, which is global in scope. So you think about, you know, the fact that this type of exploitation is happening all over the world in different forms. But it seems like the way to approach it is on the local and we say micro, but on the personal scale. So the ways in which we as individuals and our communities can address this, and that sets examples and that sets the stage for creating networks and forms of aid for other communities as well. Mm-hmm. Is that the way that that's traditionally been addressed with sort of intersectional class struggle?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, part of the class struggle tradition is internationalist and has an eye towards what they call like the universal kind of class position and class interest, that they say, you know, all workers share this position. And so you get some of the, you know, I think really great formulations of Marx about workers of the world, you know, unite and overthrow your shackles and you have nothing to lose but your chains and things like this. So there is sort of a sense of like a shared, you know, structural experience and shared sets of interests from working people all over the world. And in that sense, I think many people in the class struggle tradition thinks that while maybe the details of each point of struggle might be different, it kind of shares this universal character. But one thing I am trying to show, or I hope readers take away from the book, is that class in all of our individual lives and each of these local experiences and local struggles is in fact different. It's experienced differently. There are different histories, different populations, different experiences, different racial compositions, you know, different cultural traditions that mean that each site of this struggle has to take those differences into account in terms of thinking about how to best challenge these forms of oppression and exploitation. And that if we get too universal or too theoretical in how we think about this, we're going to miss the importance of those details. So, you know, what's an example? I mean, in the U.S., I think the tradition of anti-Black racism is deeply rooted in American society, and the hope to build, you know, class solidarities in the workplace have historically been and continue to be into the present extremely difficult in terms of how organizers have to overcome the animosities that are just worked into our labor system here. So it's very exciting when we see stuff like the Alabama Amazon worker strike, in which, you know, a mostly Black workforce, but Black and white workers together are attempting to organize for union representation. That's kind of a unique and distinct experience that was happening there. That means that, yeah, these struggles, we do have to think about them in the particulars. We do have to think about them in their local composition and local history.
All right. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, I was just going to ask if you could provide, you know, you just provided one example there, but some examples of this intersectional class struggle. For me, what I think of last year with the uprisings, the forms of protests and uprisings that happened last year after the murder of George Floyd, and I covered that on the podcast quite a bit. And the reason I bring that one up is because it's one of the biggest examples of seeing, you know, it's an example of, I mean, it was a moment in which we could see the brutality of the police state in full form, and it was definitely impacting people of color and Black people. They've experienced, you know, police brutality at its worst in this country for decades, if not centuries. And yet we saw so many people that were not Black, that were white, that were coming out to show solidarity and to be at the, even the most militant in those uprisings.
Right.
And that was, I think, a pretty good example of something like an intersectional class struggle. But there are many other examples, and I wanted to just ask you about that. And I know this extends far beyond the United States, and you do bring some of those up. I was just reading an article that you had published in Roar Mag, or Roar magazine. If you could talk a bit about some of those examples.
Oh, yeah, there are so many. I mean, I tend to think that, you know, when working class people engage in struggle, it necessarily is intersectional. And so the work that they're doing is intersectional. So even if people don't recognize it as such, and so we can almost pick a struggle at random, you know, and come to understand how it is, in fact, intersectional. But I think one that was particularly significant from this year, 2021, that didn't get a lot of coverage, at least in the U.S. context, was the Colombian general strike from June and July of this year. In this case, the Colombian government was seeking to impose a series of taxes and changes to payment fees and payment schedules relating from the economic crisis coming from the pandemic. And this was after roughly a year already of Colombian people facing pretty severe hardship, both from COVID and from the lockdowns and economic downturn from that last year. People essentially started to revolt. It started with street protests, but quickly moved into the unions. Student organizations quickly picked that up. And so too did indigenous groups against, you know, who had for a long time been organizing against forms of colonial violence and land displacement, but also around questions of environmental integrity and protecting indigenous claims to the environment. And all of these different segments of Colombian society sort of came together to recognize that, hey, in this government, we have systems that are seeking not only to exploit us as workers and as citizens through taxes, but through, you know, land struggles, through our future as students and our future in the environment, and sort of put together this broad working class you know, coalition of different segments of the Colombian working class that was able to stage a months-long national general strike in which people were refusing their labor and staging pretty dramatic conflicts with the police in cities in Colombia. So, you know, and this was, for example, roughly at the same time that there were a few hundred people in Cuba who were demonstrating against the Cuban government's forms of restrictions around COVID. And while that got a ton of attention because U.S. media has always been interested in kind of promoting anti-communism, the closest hemispheric ally of Colombia barely got noticed in U.S. media. But that struggle was a much more widespread and deeply rooted struggle, and much more significant. And I think, you know, necessarily, intersectional. So and we can see it all the time. I mean, certainly what you were pointing to in the 2020, national uprisings in the United States around Black Lives Matter and the murder of George Floyd, I think was intersectional. In that same way, we saw labor groups get mobilized here where I am in Seattle. For example, the Seattle Police Officers Union was kicked out of the labor council for the county. So there are all these ways in which these struggles are evidently intersectional before us. But if we don't take the time to recognize it, it passes us by.
Yeah. Yeah, I was seeing. I think it's really interesting because it can start with one of these. When I think of intersectionality, I think of it like being a web or a matrix of interconnecting issues. So on one aspect of the way of that web, last year, you know, we're talking about the George Floyd uprisings, mm-hmm. was anti-Black violence, police brutality, and then that was situated within the economic crisis of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like once one thing happens, it can really spread to becoming an intersectional struggle.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case in almost every struggle, really. It doesn't seem like it doesn't sound like a single issue, you know, and I think I feel like when a lot of these struggles, and I'm using the George Floyd uprisings as an example, but please, you know, extend this beyond this as well. Mm-hmm. But it starts off being dealing with an issue that is on, you know, it's at a point on that web. It starts to spread to other aspects, and then you start to see the ruling class. I saw a lot, you know, with the George Floyd uprisings. It's like, how can we reduce the struggle back down to something that can be contained, mm-hmm. so that it's like, okay, yeah, this is affecting all these different things. It's, if you know, we're seeing all these labor groups and other forms of struggle come into this. Well, let's try to reduce it back to one thing, which is about, you know, Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. and let's not even address police brutality anymore. You know, like we can contain that even. Mm-hmm. So it seems like that's one of the things is that actually the system wants to reduce the intersectional aspect of these struggles and make it into a single issue that can be, you know, contained. Does that seem right to you?
Well, I mean, I think one way you really see it in the Black Lives Matter struggle from 2020. Is the move to emphasize, you know, sort of Black capitalism as a response to the movement, which is doing a couple things. I think it's kind of defanging the disruptive street protests that had such an important and powerful impact and really led to some pretty dramatic changes in some cities. But it's also, you know, shifting the very issue of the struggle from like police violence to, you know, concerns that are very acceptable to capitalism in the United States around sort of, you know, merit-based economic growth and entrepreneurship. And, you know, Black writers for a long time, Manny Marable among them, but Walter Rodney and other people have sort of, you know, warned against this move around taking the class politics out of Black struggle in the United States and moving it onto a strictly kind of like question of racial achievement within the framework of capitalism. And Manny Marable in particular is pretty explicit. Like we cannot undo structures of racism without addressing the question of capital and capitalist exploitation in the United States. There is not going to be a kind of black-white wealth equality so long as there's overriding wealth inequality and the need to exploit workers here. And I think you kind of see that move happening all the time. And as movement activists, we need to be really cautious of that and critical of that. We need to think about the ways that our movements are able to be co-opted. And part of the reason why it's successful is because that argument is so seductive. It's like, yes, Black people in this country experience much greater forms of wealth inequality. And so creating forms of economic viability for Black people who are struggling are extremely important. But if we accept that without being critical of the end game there, I think it sort of undermines the struggle to a degree.
Yeah, it seems like what's coming up just in having this conversation with you is the ways in which intersectionality is something that we, those of us on the left that are coming from the ground level on this, using this as a way to enhance and to broaden the struggle in order to overcome all the various forms of oppression that exist. Mm-hmm. But it also seems that intersectionality is the way, it's a way as for the ruling class to continue to exist and to assert itself as well. It's almost like what I saw last year, again, with the, I'm just using these uprisings as an example. I know there's so many other examples of this, but using, you know, call it co-opting, but basically there was a response from the Black kind of business class, or those that had somehow been kind of welcomed into the system and benefited from it on a certain level. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones some of the first to actually react against the riots and to react against that form of resistance. And saying that that's not what this is about. This is about police brutality. This isn't about class struggle. This isn't about all these other issues. Mm-hmm. It's about this singular issue. It seems to me that's also a form of intersectionality in a way. It's like bringing people that have been traditionally oppressed under this system and giving them certain benefits. And then, I don't know, does that make sense? Am I making sense with what I'm saying? I feel like I'm getting a little into the weeds here, but I'm trying to point to something. I'm having a hard time articulating it though.
No, I think it does. And for me, what it gets me thinking about is that, so often in the discussion of race in this country, there's kind of this reductive approach to like the Black experience or the immigrant experience as if it's monolithic and uniform and everyone shares that same experience. And that's not at all the case. These questions are profoundly defined by class. So there is, in fact, class struggle within Black communities in the United States. There's questions of class interest that shape people's politics. Similarly for constructions of like whiteness. And I think so much of what we've seen in these debates and the rise of the far right is a tension, a class struggle around how we define racial identity. And what we emphasize in terms of whether we're emphasizing sort of solidarity and humane values or, racially exclusive, class-defined communities. And I think that's happening in Black communities as much as it's happening in white communities, although in very different ways. And if we ignore that, those kinds of like, we could call them internal struggles or internal divisions, we're missing a big part of how power works and how we should try to fight against it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the final, subject I would like to talk about is the pandemic. Mm-hmm. It seems that, I mean, you've written about it in your article for Roar magazine. And so I want to ask you in the ways in which this, because for me, it seems like out of the pandemic, so many issues have come up, including this question around labor. We've seen, it seems like a pretty common thing across the United States, an explosion of what seems to be labor activism, a real push more than there has been in the past for unionization among workers. There's also been other issues where it seems like businesses are struggling to, what do they call it? The Great Resignation, I think is the term that's being used now. Mm-hmm. It seems like now more than ever, we're seeing an emphasis on the economic side of this. In your analysis, how does intersectional class struggle address this question around all of the various crises that have emerged out of the pandemic? How have you attempted to address this subject in your work?
Well, I mean, the pandemic is an interesting and pretty, horrifying case because the stakes are so high and the widespread and largely preventable deaths that we're seeing are clearly a reflection of a class divided society in which private property takes precedence over people's lives. And because our lives are valued differently in property, that means Black and Brown lives are being lost and Indigenous lives are being lost at rates greater than others. So, for example, one of the most defining characteristics of the pandemic since the vaccine has been established is that the intellectual property rights on vaccine manufacturing have remained in private hands. This means that the pharmaceutical companies have been reaping billions of dollars in windfall profits from selling vaccines to large wealthy governments like the United States and Western Europe, while they are under no obligation to sell or provide or allow other pharmaceutical companies in other countries to develop the vaccine for much of the developing world. So, for the United States, while we're struggling to get towards 70% vaccinated, entire continents like Africa have barely 1% of the population vaccinated. Some of the poorest countries have 0.5% or 0.1% of the population vaccinated. So there's kind of a global vaccine inequality that is being defined along racial lines, clearly, but also the main buttress for that is these private property rights that are a core component of class and capital. So it's evident right before our eyes, if we choose to kind of be curious about what's happening and think about what it is that we see. In terms of the question that you were asking about the Great Resignation and the kinds of labor struggles that we've seen, yeah, this is a very interesting moment. And it's a moment, I think, that is on one hand material, in that we've seen many of the Western countries provide unprecedented forms of social welfare to populations to help get through the crisis and float the economy. Basically, the main reason there have been government stimulus packages and checks from the IRS is to maintain a level of consumer spending and make sure that the overall economy is viable and healthy. And that material change has given people a little bit more mobility and freedom, frankly, in order to make decisions for themselves about whether or not to return. At the same time, other people are being greatly restricted in their material freedom. For example, working mothers during the pandemic. There have been literally millions of women who have left the workforce because it's too difficult and complicated to care for children simultaneously while trying to work from home. And so these things are sort of, these material changes are putting a crimp on the labor markets that we see. And so therefore driving up the cost of labor in some places and leading to some moments of possibility for worker struggles. That's on the material side. On the cultural side, there's also seems to be, correct me if I'm wrong or tell me what you think about this, but a kind of sea change in people's consciousness throughout the pandemic, that is the move to reopen so quickly endanger people's lives, you know, create this narrative around hero workers and essential workers while not providing necessary healthcare for people who get sick and exposing people to extreme risk and danger through coronavirus infections has, you know, really changed people's consciousness in terms of why are they sacrificing themselves for these jobs that pay so little and are so, you know, not rewarding in other ways too. So it does seem like here's a moment of both material and cultural factors, consciousness coming into play to create this moment of revolt that's here. And I think in other countries too, we've seen similar things in Great Britain and other places.
Yeah. Yeah. This pandemic has, I think everybody felt it too. At the very beginning, we knew that something big was underway, and I don't think we could fully anticipate the ways in which it would reveal to us, you know, for those of us that have a certain measure of privilege in the world, like us, I mean, we live in the global north, you know, we do, like, it's interesting. It's like, culturally, the United States, let's speak as people from this country, culturally, the United States, we're struggling to get even 70% of the population to choose to get vaccinated.
Right.
So there's that, that's a cultural thing. And then on the other level, we have more vaccines than we know what to do with, right? And there's, like you mentioned, Africa. It's like, it really speaks to the legacy of colonialism and the ways in which these parts of the world have been purposefully underdeveloped through not only the legacy of colonialism, but in, you know, global capitalism as well.
Right.
So it's interesting to see all the ways in which the intersectionality of these issues, and, you know, I guess also culturally in the U.S. is interesting to see, kind of like the subject that we were talking about, how these antagonisms between various groups, these identities. So if you're white or black or indigenous, or you're an immigrant or man or woman or any of the other gender identities, these antagonisms that don't have to exist, but they do, and are used to create division among the population. Mm-hmm. And I started to see that with the pandemic, where I felt like a lack of consciousness among many portions of the population created, for me, they weren't asking the deeper or the better questions. It's like, okay, yeah, businesses are being shut down and people are not getting the proper aid that they need. Mm-hmm. So why don't we ask that question? Why is that the case? Instead of demanding that we reopen before it was safe to do so, you know? So it's interesting. I guess this pandemic has opened a Pandora's box of the ways in which these things all intersect and the struggles that come with that intersect. And I don't know. I guess I'm curious what you see as far as the potential here, because out of these types of crises, there is always the potential for these struggles to lead to more, you know, to not only towards movements that are moving towards liberation, but actually achieving certain goals. What are some of those things that you have observed in your research and in your work and in your activism that can move us towards a future that achieves more liberty and more equity or equality among the populations of the world? It's a big question. I know there's a lot in there, but I'm curious what you see in maybe the forms of activism that have emerged out of this time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I truly wish I just had a very straightforward answer to this question, but struggle is so difficult, and how people decide to come together around principles of solidarity or break apart because of the types of antagonisms we see in the society is, I mean, it's very difficult. But I do think we see glimmers of hope, and I do think that popular consciousness around these forms of oppression that we face is changing. I think that's changing through, like, the very dedicated efforts of, like, activists who have been, you know, working on educating and pushing on these questions for years. And I think we just have to figure out ways to contribute to those struggles. I mean, just one really quick example, you know, related back to the Black Lives Matter movement. In the first wave in 2014 and 15 with the murder of Michael Brown, it was a very spontaneous movement driven by people's compassion for Black people in America and hoping to see some kind of difference without a very clear notion or articulation of what that would look like. By the time we got the second wave in 2020, there were very clear demands around taking funding from police forces and placing that into nonviolent forms of social aid and mental health programs and de-escalation groups and community activist organizations. And, you know, just that very quick trajectory and very quick lineage that we saw in just a few short years, I think shows how quickly things can change if people are smart and organized about their activism and push against those structures as much as they can. You know, how this will work on the grand scheme, the number and variety of profound crises that society faces now, from climate to police violence and the pandemic and wealth inequality, questions of femicide and violence against women. I mean, it is rough. It is very rough out there. And until we are able to see that solidarity across difference, meaning have recognize authentic differences and work across and between those differences with each other, we're going to continue to be in trouble. But I am profoundly hopeful. I think for all the hardness we've seen, there is a lot of potential for movements to break through and change things very quickly. So I'm always hopeful for that.
For sure. Well, I guess the final thing I'd ask is, in a general sense, when you see all these, like whether it's the labor struggles or whether it's, you know, any of these other things we're seeing, do you, in a general sense, because you looked at this historically, so you're looking at from, I mean, you're going back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you're going through all of that. So do you get a general sense? Because I feel like a lot of what people were saying, those that were agitating, organizing back in the early 19th century or whatever it may be, they were talking about many of the same things that we're talking about today. Do you feel, one thing I do feel though, is that there is a general raising of consciousness about the nature of intersectional struggle. Do you get the sense that that's happening, at least on a consciousness level?
I do. And to some degree, I hope that this book reflected that kind of change in the zeitgeist that, we have to, intersectional struggle around race and gender. Certainly, there's been a growing tradition of that for the last few decades. And now, with the kinds of inequality that we're seeing and the increased workers' movements and class struggle, a greater recognition that class struggle, as part, sort of this permanent antagonism that we see in society, this kind of unending conflict between employers for profits and working people for better conditions and a better life. These things are not going to go away until we start talking about them all together and struggling against them all together, and recognizing that we face different struggles, although they all can point in the same direction if we work towards that. So yeah, I do hope that it reflects the zeitgeist, and I do hope that we start to see this more and more in movements, and I think we are moving in that direction. Yeah,
I just want to say, an appreciation of your book, because you are, it is a very clear articulation. It is a very clear analysis of intersectionality. And I think now, especially when there's so much forms of misinformation, all kinds of, propaganda that is meant to agitate in certain directions, it's like there's so much confusion around just even the term intersectionality. Mm-hmm. There's certain reasons for that, which is a whole other discussion. Mm-hmm. We didn't get into that as much, but there is a whole reason for that. But I think your book just very clearly lays it out in terms that I think anybody can pick up and understand. So I do appreciate that a great deal about your book. So thank you very much for writing it.
Well, thank you. No, I that's really good to hear. And yeah, I hope it's received in that way and can help movements first and foremost.
Yeah. Well, I'll just ask finally, so people could pick up your book through AK Press. I'll be putting a link to that in the description of this episode when I release it. Are there any other resources or any other events that are coming up for you that you want people to know about before we conclude?
Well, for me, yeah, I'm going to be part of the labor studies seminar at the University of Washington Tacoma coming up in November. If folks want to hop on that, that's going to be like a live webinar. And then there'll be some future appearances as I promote the book into December and January. So watch out for those too.
Okay. Well, I'll be sure to put that in the description as well. I'll have this interview out within a couple weeks from now. So hopefully everything will be happening around that time or after that, so people can join in on that.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I thank you so much for the book and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It was really great to talk with you.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you'd like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo at Lastborn Podcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.